I'm in the office with Dr. Vikas Pasi and Barbara Schaefer. Barbara's from Northumberland. We know her from interviews in the past talking about RSD and research into that. Since then, she has, as a result of that condition, intractable pain is something that she experiences. Opioids are something that can be a factor in her treatment, but now that the opioid crisis is underway, a lot has evolved in the medical field, and so we're going to talk to the doctor about that and Barbara about this, and a lot has happened. So, in this day and age, today, if you're dealing with pain, nobody just automatically says, okay, well, you need oxy or something like that. There's a whole philosophy that goes with properly treating pain. Opioid might be a tool that you have in your facility, but it's not the go-to. Explain your approach to treating pain.
Sure. My approach is, I believe, very consistent with what has been mandated and recommended as treatment for chronic pain syndrome. We want to identify an organic basis for pain to be occurring. We want to stipulate that it is a chronic level of pain. And for the purposes of our discussion, I'm excluding, you know, an acute, you know, motor vehicle accident and things of that nature. We're leaving those issues to the side. We're today talking about chronic pain, which has a technical definition. In my definition and the way I practice, which I think is appropriate to the guidelines, it is pain that limits a person's ability to perform their activities of daily living. It is a pain that is refractory to other modalities and other medications, such as non-opioid medications, anti-inflammatories, etc., physical therapy, things of that nature. And it is a pain that has a defined organic basis. And in those instances, it is appropriate to ease the pain and suffering of the patient, with the stipulation that that condition is reassessed frequently and periodically, and that we take a serious look at dosage reduction whenever possible, and that we make sure that the patient is using the medication as prescribed, that there's no diversion or misuse of the medication. And all of those, I think, are very appropriate mandates and ones that I try to follow very closely.
Barbara, it's important that we say here that we are not talking about treating addicts. We aren't talking about treating people that don't need to be in front of Dr. Pasi. Explain that we are talking about individuals who need pain treatment through a wide range of the methods that he'll use, and opioids can be a help for some.
Well, I've done a lot of years. I've been talking to people who have chronic pain and intractable pain. And once we've tried many of the types of treatments that are available, if our insurances will pay for them, then we do need to have pain control. And maybe opioids are the only thing that will help a person's pain. And you can't expect it to take it all away. Some people do. What you expect is to get enough reduction in your pain that you can function in life in a decent way and not spend your life in bed or not doing things because you can't stand the pain. So that's where opioids come in. And I agree with Dr. Pasi. When the pain is doing better or you get a new treatment that helps you somewhat, that's the time to step back. Take less medicine. I have a history of going up and down. If I get a flare-up, I may need to increase my dose. Once that flare-up is over, I tend to go back to where I was before. So it's not an addiction. Addiction comes when you will use that medicine and do anything to get that medicine, even though it's bad for you. So if you're willing to steal from your daughter or your mother because you need that money to buy drugs, that's an addict's behavior. You go out of the way to do things that are dangerous or not good for you just because you need that drug. Or pain patients may ask for more drugs, more medicine, because they need more pain control. Control their pain, they'll stop asking for it. They won't do things that are bad for them because they need the medicine.
Well, that's a good stepping off point into the idea that a lot of deaths occur because of opioids. We have a crisis. So What's causing that separate aspect of the crisis?
Personally, I don't think, and from the statistics that I can find, it's not pills. It's street drugs, heroin, fentanyl. Our coroner in Northumberland County, Mr. Kelly, on May 2nd, there was an article in the Daily Item where he talked about most of the drugs deaths they're seeing, the overdose deaths, are common mixed-up drugs. People have many different drugs in their system. We've seen an astronomical raising of meth in this area as part of the drugs in a person's body when they die of an overdose. Fentanyl. Our people who sell on the street are sticking a little bit of fentanyl in the heroin. Why? Get you higher. You want more. You'll buy more. But what happens? A person is using what they can without getting overdosed, gets a little fentanyl in it, and they're dead. I have a friend whose fiance died that way. He was using the same dose he'd always used, but somebody in that neighborhood was putting fentanyl in. Five people died that day within a four-block radius of the city they lived in from that one drug pusher. So I don't think it's the pills. The pills prescriptions have been going down. Between 2016 and 2017, an estimated 14.3 million fewer prescriptions were written for opioids in this country. And yet, the death rate has risen tremendously. They are inversely related to each other, not one causing the other.
And doctor, what she's describing literally has nothing to do with the practice that you're doing here, dealing with chronic pain or intractable pain appropriately in a wide range of ways and sometimes with opioids.
That is correct. That is correct. Where I think the medical community's responsibility lies is to be aware that we're using these medications appropriately, that we are questioning each time we evaluate the patient, and we should evaluate them frequently, whether the dosage can be reduced, whether the condition that we are treating still exists, or whether there's something else that we can offer the patient. So I do think we have a responsibility to use these medicines very judiciously, but there is a role for these medications in chronic pain.
But if I go to Washington and I say, we're dealing with the opioid crisis from Washington out, they don't do this differentiation of opioids that are appropriate and dosed properly and monitored versus what Barb is describing on the street. It's just opioids.
Well, I think this is where, we have to understand that, as I think I said earlier, the truth is often in the middle. It is not appropriate to say that opioids are bad or good. Opioids are a tool. How we use them is what makes them bad or good. And so we, as a medical community, have a responsibility to use this class of medicine, as we have with any class of medicine, to use it responsibly and in the right way. We should use blood pressure medicine in the right way and responsible way. Where there are guidelines to use that, or diabetic medicine. And similarly, when you identify a patient with chronic pain who has no other modality that will help them, whose life is compromised, then there is a role for these medications with frequent reassessment and assurance that it's being used safely.
Barbara, there are people on the pain scale who are a 10 who can't get meds that would help.
Yeah, there's a pain scale we use from a 1 to 10. 1 is virtually no pain. When you get to around 4 or 5, it's disturbing. It takes your attention when you're doing something. But when you get as high as a 9 or a 10, you can't function. Before I had the treatments that I have now, and I have a number of different treatments, one is medication, the others are things like acupuncture and a meditation, not medication. But when you get to a 10, is when you can't function at all. I call it getting lost in Walmart. I'm in a power wheelchair. When I get to a 10 in a store, I lay back in my chair because I can't find the exit. I can't find the person I came with. I sit there till they find me. I can't even use my phone to call them when the pain is that bad. Luckily, I have enough tools between medication, acupuncture, and being able to just relax myself that now I can control from getting to a 10 very often. But if I didn't have any opioids, I'd probably be back up there again.
Tell me what happens to people who can't get pain meds that they do need for chronic or intractable pain.
I've been working in the pain community for many years as a support person. And I know many people who have just killed themselves because they spent 10 years waiting to get something to control their pain. They've had 4, 5, 6, 7 years good because they've had pain medication and they can function. Maybe not what you would call functioning, but we call functioning. They're having some fun in life. They're doing some things. And then they take their medicine away and they can't go back to where they were. And the one example is a friend, I didn't know him, but people told me about him and I read about it in the paper, so I know it happened. He told his wife that his physician had taken half his medicine away 1 month, and the next month he was going back to see him. And he told his wife that if the physician took the rest of his opioids away, he would kill himself because he could not live that way. And he did, with a gun, in the doctor's office. She knew he was going to do it, but she couldn't ask him to live through that again either.
That incident, very unusual, but that dilemma, widespread.
I cannot say that I've experienced that personally because I think that we as a practice have judiciously prescribed pain medication. But I don't doubt Barbara's word and report. I've known Barbara for many years, and so I think that as I say, there is got to be a middle way here. There is this condition of chronic intractable pain, regardless of cause, right? We can. It's beyond the scope of our discussion to say what the causes of chronic intractable pain are. Needless to say, there are many. RSD, cancers, many, many causes. And I think those people still merit treatment. And in that sense, I endorse what Barbara is saying. I do not think that, I think that as a physician, your charge is to ease suffering. And if you have a tool that does it, use it safely and use it to ease suffering. Absolutely.
What should people do? What should the whole community do?
In what sense?
Should we contact our congressman? Should we write a letter? I mean, is there, it seems that you talk about this middle ground, that sounds like an ideal place to be, but we aren't there.
Well, I think part of what we're doing here to raise consciousness that there are people in chronic pain is part of it. I have a feeling, I guess feeling is not the right word, but a sense that this is one of those pendulums. I have practiced medicine long enough to know that, 10 or 15 years ago, not treating pain was considered anathema, and not giving narcotic medications was considered borderline malpractice. And I think that was incorrect. I think that probably led to some overprescription. And I think now, we are at the opposite end of that. And I think people like Barbara speaking out and people prescribing medicine and practicing medicine judiciously, doing it right, will hopefully get the pendulum back to a middle ground.
I just wanted to say one thing. The National Pain Organization of Doctors has come out and said that when people take medicine for chronic pain, opioid medicine, and they take it correctly, there's some 3-5% addiction rate. So most people out there are addicted. And some of them may have taken their mother's pills that were sitting in the closet. And I'm a very strong believer in you don't overprescribe. You don't send someone home from the hospital with 30 pills that they may only need 2 or 3 days worth. Because that rest of that 30 pills usually sits in the medicine chest, and some kid comes along maybe and takes it, and then people who are susceptible to addiction start using it for another reason besides pain. But it's a 3-5% addiction rate for people who take opioids for pain.
Solutions. What has to happen in the years ahead, locally and in Washington, Parisburg?
First thing I think needs to happen is I think insurances need to pay for other pain treatments. There are blocks, there's meditation, there's psychological counseling, there's acupuncture, but many people's insurances will not pay for any of this. So what do they have besides the pills or the street drugs to control their pain?
I would completely endorse that. I practice acupuncture and agree that it can be a modality. I refer often to physical therapy. There are many things that we can do to help with chronic pain that is beyond, above and beyond medication. And then I come back to practicing medicine the right way. You know, what can I do? I can make sure that I identify the patients who are chronic patients versus those who do not have a pain syndrome and are not appropriate for these medications, that I think long and hard about how I prescribe and how we prescribe, and that we periodically reassess, reduce dose, and that we do it judiciously so that any role that we have, we've had in the past in contributing to this crisis is alleviated. And so that we have a sense that the community in general and the lawmakers have a sense that we are doing this appropriately. And I think that's what the medical community has to do. The answer is not we're not going to prescribe pain medicine. The answer is we're going to prescribe it correctly.
And what all is in your tool belt? Medicines are part of it.
Sure.
Pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
Physical therapy. Acupuncture.
Yes.
What else is in your tool belt?
So, as Barbara intimated, psychological counseling. You know, often there is, as you can imagine, a very significant overlay between pain and depression. And so treating a person's depression through counseling and or medication for that purpose is certainly within our tool belt. And then, you know, I perhaps don't know quite how to word it, a relationship over time with a patient, I think, is very helpful.
Yes.
Knowing your patient over years and saying, you know, I don't think this is really an exacerbation of your pain, or I do think this is an exacerbation of your pain. Knowing that person and having their trust is very key, so that we're not just, well, here you are, I'm going to just give you more pills, you know. It is that level of communication that helps.
I don't know if people realize that most opioid prescriptions are written by family practitioner doctors. That a pain doctor may say, you need this, but your family practitioner will be the one who gives it to you. And the script comes to him or her, and they manage it. So it's really important. And again, insurances need to make sure doctors make enough money that they can take that extra few minutes to talk to a patient that they've known for years, and that they feel they're ready to go down on their dosage of opioid. And it might be scary for that person because they didn't have any pain control, then they have pain control with opioids, and now you want to take it down. But if they trust the doctor and he's got that extra, he or she has that extra few moments to speak to you and explain to you, let's give it a try. If it doesn't work, we can go back up. Then a patient's going to trust him. Again, money comes into it so often because if insurance doesn't give a doctor enough money that he can make a good salary and still spend these extra few minutes with the patients who need it, you have a problem there for those patients because they may turn around and go out on the street and buy stuff just because they don't understand it. They don't trust it. Most people I know, when the doctors try to lower their medicine, that's exactly what they need, to trust the person and to trust that if they need more, they can get it back. They're not addicts. They don't need it for the fun of it. I have never gotten high on pain medicines. I don't even know what it would feel like to be high on pain medicines. I have no idea why someone would be an addict, because I don't understand that. Because I use the medicine just to control some of my pain. Not all of it. I don't think I'll ever get total pain control. But again, enough that I can still go out and do things and feel better than I do without it.
I'm not going to talk politics, but when you hear a political candidate say we need Medicare for all so that we stop leaving so many people untreated for a wide range of things or promoting wellness, do you respond to that favorably when you hear that?
Yes, I do, except for, truthfully, Medicare won't pay for a lot of the treatments either.
When you hear politicians discussing this, do you say, oh, that would help?
Here's what I would say, that there's a large segment of our population that does not have appropriate medical coverage. You know, deciding how we get there is above my pay scale. But the fact that there is not enough coverage for, and now we're talking broadly here, medical conditions, not just chronic pain, medical conditions and medications, is not something that I have to tell your audience. That is, pardon the pun, painfully apparent every day in my life. So absolutely, this should be a priority in our country.
somebody comes to the front office here now and says, I'd like to see the doctor, my knee is killing me, I'd like some pain meds.
Right.
That's not how we practice medicine here.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, we're going to figure out why your knee is killing you. What is the appropriate next medical step? The last thing we're going to do is trying to just treat a pain condition without knowing what else we can do to alleviate it. And that is a positive change in medicine. That I think, is the way it should be done.
Can I, when you ask me about Medicare for All, I don't care if it's a government-run program or not. I just think medical care is to be available for all. I think it needs to be non-profit, because I think profit, especially things that are on the companies that are on the the Wall Street companies, they work only for profit. They don't work for patients. So I think we need to have some kind of insurance for everybody, a good one. And once Dr. Passy told me that if he didn't have 46,000 different insurance policies that had different rules, different medicines they would approve, he could see 1/3 more patients. I don't know if he still feels that way, but he said this a number of years ago to
maybe
me.
Maybe not quite.
And I think
third,
it's probably got worse as far as the amount of paperwork he has to do just to get treated. But if we can get rid of that, then our doctors will have more time to spend with patients to figure out what's wrong with them. They will know what the insurance would cover if there's 4 or 5 different insurances, not as many as we have now. They could know what different insurances would cover. It doesn't have to be government run, but everybody has to have insurance that they can afford, and they have to have not a zillion different paperwork and rules for each different insurance company. Because I'm a really intelligent person. I've dealt with a lot of medical stuff, and yet they will not hand me a copy of my policy before I buy it. So I don't know what drugs it's going to cover. I don't know what treatments it'll cover, because I can't read the actual policy until I've already got it, and I have no choice but to keep it for a year at least. Think about that. They give you a 2-page thing telling you what their insurance is about, but they have a 450-page manual. I'm exaggerating. It's not that big. But I'm a person who likes to read what I'm actually getting, and I'll never see that. Not in the way things are run now in insurance.
Elaborate.
She's said it very well. From my narrow perspective, I will say that one of the more frustrating aspects of my job is dealing with insurance companies and the number of rules and rule changes and what's covered and what's not covered, and the fact that what's covered today may not be covered next month. And I think all human beings can appreciate that we all have a certain amount of mental energy, and that's all we have to give in a day. And increasingly, more and more of a physician's energy is spent on these, I'll call them administrative tasks, than medicine, and that should change.
Tell me about the issue of addiction. You and I talked about that a little bit before we came in here. She said, we have an addiction problem. Sort of how we got to that, opioids or alcohol or other substances may be the particular items that we get stuck on, but we have an addiction problem. Why is that?
Wow, do you have a few months?
Because the world is inhabited by people. That's
right.
The problem.
Right. I mean, again, you're asking a philosophical question that I'll say for the scope of this interview is above my pay grade. But her broader point is well taken. You see, as I said earlier, opioids are a tool. If you magically disappeared all opioid pills from the world today, do we imagine in 3 months there would be no addicts?
No.
Of course, there would be addicts. So the broader issue is that of addiction. Now, as I say, much beyond the scope of our discussion today about, why there is addiction, why certain places have more addiction. Suffice it to say they do, but opioids are an expression of that. They're not a cause of that.
Addiction
I described as people who do things that are bad for them to get a drug or alcohol. I mean, think about an alcoholic. Think about people who drink and drive. And they get busted. And they get put in jail for 2 months. And they come out. And they know if they drive again, they're going to go to jail for a year this time. But they got to have that drink. So they get in the car and drive down to the bar. Because not only do they have to have a drink, they got to have it with their buddies. They get caught. Now they got to go to jail for a year. They knew that was bad for them, but they did it anyway. Because they needed that alcohol. When people are addicts to opioids, it's the same thing. They need that drug. So they go out on the street and buy it. Most of them don't get it from their doctors because you can't up it. They don't give you enough. They give you enough for what you take. So you can't just add something to it. So they go out on the, you know, they're not addicts. They're taking what the doctor says. If they need more, they go and ask. If the doctor says, no, let's wait, let's try this, they'll do that if they give them something to try. They're not addicts. I don't know why we have addicts. I just know it's a bad problem in all kinds of ways now. It seems to me that I'm 70 years old, just 70 years old, and I'm seeing the world's going faster and faster, and things are changing faster and faster. Maybe that's just hard for people to handle. I don't know. Because the amount of addiction has gone up tremendously.
An additional remark from either of you, or both of you. Barbara, what else to add? Anything else you'd like to talk about?
I told you that I don't think this is caused by pills prescribed by doctors, this addiction problem we're having now. But I do think both ends of the scale on opioids have to work together. We have to support the people who are addicts and getting the illegal drugs off the street. They have to support our ability to get the medicines we need. Otherwise, we're just ramming heads against each other, and that's not the way to get where we are, where we need to go. We need to work together. We need to get people and the government to understand that it's not from the prescriptions. And actually, the CDC just came out on April 9th with a thing to doctors who had written to them about the fact that they're going after doctors for prescribing opioids to intractable pain people. And the CDC is kind of coming out and saying, this is not what was meant to be, and that doctors should pay attention to the good practices of their particular specialty. So an oncology doctor, if the oncology practices are to give pain meds, that's okay, let them do it. So don't just follow the CDC, follow whatever your Department of Medicine says is an important thing to do in good practices.
An additional remark?
Well, I would dovetail off what she said. I think as physicians, we do have a responsibility to make sure that we are prescribing opioids in a very judicious manner and that we are reassessing the need for them frequently. Having said that, there are people in the world who suffer from chronic pain, and it is within the scope of our practice to try to ease that pain. It is the good thing that has come out of the attention to this problem is that I think physicians are much more judicious in evaluating patients who need pain medication, evaluating the amounts that they're giving. And we have a responsibility as physicians to make sure that we do it in this way so that those pills are not misused. And if we do that, I think we can come to a common ground.
What do you say to everybody in the whole central Susquehanna Valley who is or may ever take any kind of pill or have any kind of pain? Advice for people around here?
Well, if you're talking about, pain as a daily occurrence or an occasional occurrence, my advice is that there are many modalities besides opioids to handle that sort of condition. If you're saying to me someone who has cancer or RSD or some intractable pain, whether I think narcotics should be a part or opioids should be a part of their pain regimen, I think once you try all other modalities, if you have residual pain that is intractable and keeping you from functioning, then I think it's reasonable with frequent assessment, to prescribe those medications. I think it depends on the patient, and so it comes down to the relationship.
All right.
Can I say one more thing?
Oh, please. Go ahead.
I have a condition that's one of the highest levels of pain that's been measured. I see my treatment, my control of my pain, as a three-legged stool. I have the psychological help of being able to do self-meditation, self-hypnosis, and a counselor to speak to. I have the physical help of PT, acupuncture, all those kinds of things. And then I have the opioids, which are my form of pain control. And I take one type of pill and only one type of pill for it. And if you take any of those legs out, I'm going to fall like a three-legged stool. So I need to have those three in order for me to be outside, going to listen to music, helping a little bit in the house. I can't do much, but I can help a little bit. To be able to smile more and actually laugh. I actually feel like I came alive with some of my treatments recently. So I can't lose any of them. I can change them. I can use less opioids if one of them does better. But I can't lose any because the stool will